Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Dedicated to Henry Farman. In the year of the primal thought, from the dawn of terrestrial birth, man mastered the mammoth and fort, and man was the lord of the earth. He made him an hollow skin from the heart of an holy tree. He compassed the earth therein, and man was the lord of the sea. He controlled the vigor of steam, he harnessed the lightning for hire, he drove the celestial team, and man was the lord of the fire.
Welcome to episode 45 of Agitators Anonymous. Meanwhile, back at the funny farm. Lemmy, you died at the right time, didn't you? Got out before all of this madness. Oh well. Well, anyway, episode 45 is a chat with a very good friend of mine. His name is Nicholas Barker. You should know him from Dimmu Borgir, Cradle of Filth, Lockup, Brujeria, amongst many, many others. He has played on probably the two biggest selling black metal albums of all time, actually. Well, second wave of black metal, I guess. Which he never really seemed to have thought about until I mentioned it to him. Anyway, you can hear it all in our chat. It's really interesting and long one. All about Nick's career, drumming, where he grew up, the old UK scene, all sorts of things. Really good. So, off the top, you can follow me in my rather dull adventures over on Instagram at nemthianga_primordial. They're mainly tired polemics and grumpy frustrations, but you can follow me nonetheless. Over at patreon.com/AlanAverill. If you want to support the show, I post other podcasts, various bonus stuff, the odd extra this and that, discussions, all sorts of other things to try and fend off the apocalypse. The sponsors to mention are HateCouture616.com, HateCouture. Mention the code Alan and you will get free shipping. All sorts of hateful yet tasteful nasty apparel, meaning t-shirts. Go and have a look. If you are in North America, you can go to www.metalblade.com. 40 years of heavy metal to choose from. Do me a favor, buy the new Dread Sovereign album, perhaps. Mention the promo code Alan and you will get 10% off your order. And if you are into RPGs, role-playing games, www.lotfp.com. Use the promo code AAAA. And you will get 2 free books if you order 3. Those are the choice of the author. If you're into role-playing games, all that kind of thing, go and check it out. You can find the information that I just read out is on my YouTube channel. This is also a video cast with Nick, so if you want to look at our ugly faces, go and subscribe, share, and look at all the other stuff on my YouTube channel. That would be very helpful. Thank you very much. And like I said, the info of all 3 sponsors is there under description. I've also started doing a thing called Call from the Grave. Got to keep busy. the devil makes work for idle hands, as they say, and he's certainly doing a good job on rearranging my grey matter at the moment. But I'm doing this thing called Call from the Grave, which is a bit like the column I'm doing for Zero Tolerance magazine, where I go over the career retrospective of an old band, mainly a reason for me to show off old vinyls and t-shirts. So please indulge me and again go over to my YouTube channel and take a look. Right, let's get into it. I should mention before we get going that Nick has a new band called Borstal, raging, violent, hardcore stuff, with his friends in a band called Knuckle Dust. And look, it's heavy, heavy, old hardcore vibes. It's got Chromags, it's got Agnostic Front, it's got all of that kind of stuff, Terror, all that kind of heavy old hardcore stuff. And you can go and take a look over at bandcamp.com. Just put in Borstal HC, Borstal Hardcore, BORSTALHC.bandcamp.com. Go and take a look and have a listen. All right, Nick, let's do it.
All right, Mr. Barker, how are you? Well, we've been through that already, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, you know, I'm all right. You know, just dealing with the COVID, cabin fever, you know, the usual. You know what 2021 has to offer so far.
2021 days later, or 2021 days later, or whatever you want to call
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I was thinking about this, right? And I was rooting through my 7 inches and I found Monolith.
Right. Wow.
And so, but where I want to start with this is because everyone's a bit sick of the situation that we're in. So I want to talk about music and drums and making music and all the big career that you've had. And so I have quite a few questions. But the start of it is it or is it not Catalepsy, Faces of Death?
Yes, that was the demo, and then there was a band already called Catalepsy.
Yeah.
It's a shit name anyway.
Yeah.
Then the record company Vinyl Solution, which owned Cacophonous, their A&R guy, Rob Tennant, he was the one that suggested change it to Monolith.
Yeah.
And we thought it sounded way better, so we rolled with that.
Yeah, and so I said, I found the 7-inch there. So the 7-inch, so the Catalepsy became Monolith, because I remember I had my mate had the Catalepsy demo, right?
Yeah.
And you were writing to him, and he lived up the road from me, and he came down with the demo, and he goes, oh, this guy, the drummer's messaging me. And then you said, I think, that Catalepsy were supposed to play in Dublin with Cancer, maybe?
Yes, that's correct.
That maybe 91, is it, 92?
92, it was supposed to be, I believe it was with Scorn as well, Mick Harris's side thing. Yeah, but some reason, I don't think the Irish dates happened, just because the costs involved, you know, getting over there, and, you know, the fees involved, and et cetera, you know, the deal.
Yeah.
We were actually called Monolith at that time, when we signed to Cacophonous, which was owned by Vinyl Solution. We released the 7-inch. We recorded an album called Tales of the Macabre, and it got shelved, basically.
Whatever happened to that?
Nothing. They just shelved it. I've tried getting in touch with them to get the masters back and a DAT tape, because it was recorded on quarter-inch, 8-track.
Oh, yeah. We did that a few times as well.
Yeah, we did it totally obituary, slowly we rot. World Downfall style.
Yeah.
You know, we recorded the drums on like 7 tracks, and then we bounced them down to 2-track stereo.
Oh, yeah.
So there was room for the guitars and everything else. But yeah, I mean, we were supposed to go on a European tour with Cancer on that one, and everything just got shelved. And then, you know, around that time, I joined Cradle of Filth.
Yeah. So that was your first band then, was it, Catalepsy? Or what did you... You must have had one in the end of the 80s or early 90s then, did you?
Yeah, I mean, I had a high school kind of like thrash crossover band called Systematic Insanity. And actually, when we played the school open day, and, you know, we did like Dead Kennedys covers, Metallica, Misfits.
Sure,
yeah. And we did Last Caress. And the moment the vocalist belted out, you know, I raped your mummy today, I killed you, the teachers just had a meltdown. They're like, what?
Yeah.
We didn't agree to this.
Yeah, I think I had almost the exact same.
Actually, we we had a little bit of we had a little bit of relative local success. I mean, we played we supported Lomo of Death in a nightclub when we were all underage. We're all 15 years old going to this 18 and over metal night at the local nightclub in town, and we support we headlined it one time, and we supported Lomo of Death, and we also supported Zentrix at the time, Reanimator. Who else did we support? Acid Rain. You know, I mean, this is all at the time when, you know, the UK thrash thing was kind of, you know, doing something, but everyone sounded like Metallica in the Bay Area. But also, we used to follow Sabbat around. Because they're local guys to us. The Chesterfield Militia got a bit of a reputation because we'd fucking, we'd beat everybody else up in the pit because there was an old gang of us. And, you know, we were the notorious ones for jumping off the PA, trashing the stage. I mean, and that's basically how I became friends with Andy. You know, we used to follow him around and load all the gear in for him, and they'd let us in for free. Know, and then we get pissed and just like kill everyone in the mosh pit.
It was pretty much the same.
The systematic insanity thing. I mean, at that time, you know, I was getting more and more into the heavier, more underground stuff. You know, like at that time at school, the end of school, like 88, 89, thrash had just become really commercialized to me, you know, because, you know, Metallica had signed to a major. So all of the bands were trying to change their sound. You know, we've got to do the Metallica thing, you know, major label. And, you know, history dictates that major labels haven't got a fucking clue how to market this music whatsoever. You know, so at that time, I was getting more and more into like the death metal scene. I was tape trading.
Same story with me.
I just got tired of thrash. You know, the whole Bermuda shorts thing. You know, doing Blondie covers and this, and it just became like a parody of itself. I'm like you. I was into like Frost and Dark Angel and Slayer and Creator and you know all the mid '80s Razor and you know every band that was on Speed Kills. You know that was my Bible.
Know.
Although Speed Kills 2, I did drop a royal bollock when I bought the Living Death album, I remember, purely based on the Arctic. Before I had hike.
A hard band to get into. Vocals always did my head in a bit on Living Death. They're a bit too, sort of like a 14-year-old girl or something.
Exactly. Yeah, so, you know, basically, like, the end of my high school years, you know, I was getting more and more into the underground death metal. And then I left school, tried to get a death metal band going, Catalepsy. And unfortunately, we just missed the boat, you know, on that first wave. So by the time, you know, I'd got a record deal in like 91, 92, you know, death metal was already kind of like fizzling out, you know. Everybody sounded like Suffocation and Cannibal, you know. And it's like, then as I carried on tape trading, then, you know, all of this black metal stuff was coming through on my tape lists, you know. You know, going back to the old, like, mid-80s, you know, wearing the makeup, King Diamond, Merciful Fate, you know, early Sodom. And I totally related to it because it's like, wow, this is going back to what I loved about thrash in the beginning.
The old thrash,
Exactly. Like, there was, like, an element of mysticism to it, and you know, it was slightly intimidating, you know, with the studs and the nails and the, you know, and that's, you know, I kind of, that's how I started following like black metal. And then obviously the Cradle demo, the last Cradle demo was doing the rounds, and everybody was raving about Total Fucking Darkness. And I remember when I heard it, I did nothing like it before. You know, it was like a combination of, like, you know, it had like elements of early Sabbath, Hell, you know, Fate, King Diamond, Frost, Hellhammer, and, you know, it just, I loved it. And then through the tape trading, you know, I got talking to the guys, and, you know, we knew each other. Ironically, actually, funny story, in Monolith, we opened for Cannibal Corpse on the Tomb of the Mutilated tour with Anathema. And we did the whole UK run apart from the Marquee, which Cradle of Filth opened. And we were friends, you know, through the tape trading stuff and all that. And then Carl Stokes had a serious motorcycle accident on the eve of a cancer tour early 93, which I was supposed to be drum teching on. And he asked me, he said, look, I'm folked. I mean, he was in traction. I mean, he was all like fucking, his whole body was in a cast.
Oh, yeah.
So he asked me to drum for, fill in on the tour, which I did, with the Cerebral Fix and Gamora, I believe.
Oh, yeah, Gamora, yeah. Yeah, I remember them.
Yeah, Jose.
Yeah, Jose, yeah.
Sven, bless him, rest in peace. He was a good lad.
Yeah, he was all right. Yeah, he was a good chap.
Yeah. So I ended up playing the drums on that, and we did an all-dayer in Wrexham at the Memorial Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day. And it was Cadaver was on there, Red Harvest. And basically, it was just two package shows joined together, and the promoter said, fuck it, let's make it an all-dayer.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, the first time I met Danny and Cradle, and it was pretty much, you know, oh, come down to Suffolk and hang out, and we're going to be recording an EP, and would you be interested in, like, helping out with the productions? Yeah, great. Got down there, the drummer just had red light fever. I said, look, you know, I can do this if you want me to, and right there and then it was a done deal.
Is that really, that's how, kind of how you went down to help and then ended up just kind of like just taking the really, wow.
Well, they ditched the session after the drummer was having red light fever, and they totally ditched the session, and you know, we talked, you know, within 2 days I was down there with my clothes, my drum kit, and we were rehearsing for what would be The Principle of Evil Made Flesh.
Yeah. And that was done in the, I have many like fond memories of that old academy, that old crazy academy that like kind of.
There's no heating and the fucking damp.
and Bob's chippy across the road, you know?
Oh God, yeah. Everything fried in beef dripping.
Yeah, yeah. It's all right. I won't molest you. His daughter, like, the counter. With the battered fucking kind of cod sandwich that would make its way through the bag.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was just like saturated with like a pound of fucking beef dripping, wasn't it?
Yeah. Amazing. But those were some great memories of those old Academy studios. But
absolutely.
Was that your first time going to Academy and working with the proper, like with mags and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were thinking about studios. Where could we go and do this?
Mm.
And it was me that said, like, why don't we use Academy?
Yeah.
You know, Anathema, My Dying Bride, everybody uses it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's cheap. You know, it's in the country.
Yeah.
You know, they know this type of music.
Yeah.
So let's do that. And, we went up there. I think it was like 2 weeks. And, you know, Darren White came over and Dunk.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Darren laid down some vocals for us. And, it was a great time. I mean, back then, you know, we were all young. I was barely 20 years old. We're all on the dole. Yeah, it's all for one and one for all.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like we scrape enough money, like we can either buy food or we can buy an eighth of dirty soap bar. What's it going to be? Well, why don't we get a tea at the soap bar and I'll just buy a bag of spuds and just make some chips.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what it was like.
Yeah, well, I might remember going there in 94 to remix the first Primordial album, and we'd recorded the same kind of nonsense. We'd recorded it on a quarter-inch reel by accident, because we didn't know, on 2 8 tracks, trying to bounce things, no outboard equipment, nothing. We were using a guitar pedal for like sort of for delay, only one go with the vocals because he couldn't figure out how to drop in. So I said, we signed a cacophonous. Neil goes, right, we need to remix this piece of shit. I was like, okay. So I got the ferry to Wales and the train to meet Neil and no such thing as getting on a flight. And we had to hire a quarter inch reel machine and carry the train up to Leeds and then wheel our way through Leeds somewhere at night on a Friday night dressed, you know, with fucking trench coats and stuff.
Yeah.
With a huge metal case, getting abuse from people. And then Neil had us booked in to stay in like a squat. So it was just like an empty building in the middle of winter where we stayed for like 3 or 4 days with like dirt on the beds. And all sorts of
stuff. No heating.
No, nothing. And we had to hook up this tiny little machine with this little thing and hope that Mags could figure out how to transfer this onto a proper real machine. And he's like, some of this is in mono. Like, what have you been doing? And we're like, we don't know. with no fucking clue. But it had a thing, that old academy, the room downstairs, like the kind of spooky room, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. It was good memories there. I mean, you know, it's some great times. You know, it's, you know, we were all broke, hungry, you know, but like, that's what made us, that's what makes you who you are today, yeah. You know?
But nothing really sounded like that first Cradle. I remember getting the cassette tape off Danny and literally, you know, just being blown away, thinking like, fucking hell, this has got some raw death metal stuff, but it didn't sound northern and it didn't sound southern, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird mix because I played the blast beat on the Cradle stuff. I was inspired by the first Brutal Truth album.
All right, okay.
That's why it's all on the China in unison, yeah, rather than the kind of alternating Norwegian style, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the machine going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
You know, rather than doing the alternated Norwegian way. The Norwegian scene was still new and we were in touch with it and we liked it. But we came from a different, see, we weren't Scandinavian.
Yeah.
You know, all of our influences were more like British, you know. Sabbath was a huge influence.
Yeah.
You know, and also early At the Gates, yeah. You know, Diamond Fate, you know, that was, you know, Hellhammer Frost, that was kind of our thing. And, you know, obviously Danny's subject matter and everything, Byron Shelley, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it had a different take to the Scandinavian scene, you know, because, you know, we're a different culture.
Yeah, totally.
You know, and we totally grew up in a different way of life. I mean, there's no real sex, drugs and rock and roll culture in Scandinavia, whereas in the UK and the US,
yeah,
we kind of, both the UK and the US, we kind of created that whole
sex, drugs and asbos. Sex, drugs and asbos, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and plus, you know, we were really into like death metal as well. And I think it shows on the album.
But then it sort of, it totally does, yeah. But it must have been then to be right at the center of that when it started to explode. Being quite, you know, ready for that or have expected it. Because I think even at the time, Neil was just, I suppose, quite shocked at how quickly it just gained traction, you know?
Well, we actually recouped on pre-sales.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was a big thing. And at the time we were like thinking, wow, so that means we're going to see some checks soon.
Yeah.
Wrong. Yeah. You know, yeah. And basically, you know, the Movers and the Shakers, they used all the Cradle of Filth money to sign other artists and build the label.
Yeah.
And that's how we got into the big legal wrangle, you know, later on, because Dusk, as you know, was going to be the second album.
Yeah.
But because we'd not been accounted, we'd not seen any statements or any money from the first album, which we knew had recouped.
Yeah.
You know, we held on to the masters and said, look, pay us, show us, give us our statements. You know, everything, you're in breach of contract. We just want what's ours. We're not asking for anything more.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we know this recouped on pre-sale. So where is our money?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we withheld the masters and then the big legal wrangle ensued. And basically to get out of Cacophonous, we recorded Vampire.
Yeah. So
which meant,
but just to go back a couple of months, was the tour with Emperor was just after the album came out or for the demo? Remember the little UK?
No, that was the album wasn't even out then.
So it was just before.
We'd not even recorded it. The Emperor tour was in July and we weren't in Academy until September, October.
Okay, right, yeah, yeah.
So we were playing all of the TFD songs,
yeah,
but also playing you know, three or four songs that were going to be on Principle.
You're right, yeah, yeah.
I mean, Mr. Midnight Sky, that's like what, 9 minutes, you know. We played that, Principle, Forest Whispers My Name,
yeah, yeah,
yeah, you know. But I mean, we were opening for Emperor too, so yeah, we only had like 40 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it was a good time. So I remember it vividly, like back at Darren White's place in Liverpool. Just out, I slept on the street actually, and tried to fight the milkman in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we used to go to lots of those gigs as well. like, and get the ferry, as I said, across from like Dublin to Wales, and then get into the night ferry, and then at 8 in the morning you'd get the train, and so you just like, you know, push your way through, just fucking scag your way through all day to just get to the show, and then it'd be back to sleep in the, you know, bus station, and then make your way all the way back across to, back to Dublin. So we, I remember seeing ye with you played with in fucking, who was it with? Hecate Enthroned and Esoteric, maybe in 93, 94. The Paper Mache Goat's
Head. Oh, yeah. That thing, yeah.
That must be 93, is it?
Yeah, I think it was. Because wasn't it the Dublin Castle?
Yeah, that's it.
Mike, he didn't pay us for that gig either.
Listen, come on.
You know, he did a runner with the money.
Yeah, of course. Well, you want to kind of be him, Nick? Yeah. We used to stay in his house and everything. And we'd basically just be like sitting or lying underneath the kitchen table and all sorts of mayhem just unfolding around.
Shit everywhere,
Given a can of beans and three cans of beer. But yeah, they were kind of exciting. They were kind of exciting days as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, because the scene was new then, you know, and all of the controversy had just broken. So there was this real, like I said, like mysticism and like intrigue and like, whoa, you know, I mean, because at that time, the only other genre of music, which I'm a fan of, that was killing each other was all the gangster rap. You know, gangster rappers and then these white, self-harming kids from Scandinavia that you know had personality defects or whatever, you know.
So the first European tour then is what is it, Anathema and At the Gates in 94, is it maybe?
Yes, yeah, January 94. What happened was Anathema, they needed they I think it was supposed to be Pyogenesis were opening and they pulled out or something. Something happened anyway, and they were looking for an opening band. And, you know, to ride on the bus,
blah, blah, blah.
You know, we can't pay you, but you'll get fed and watered and you've got a place to sleep at night. And we were like, I think Paul Ryan, the Ryan brothers were kind of reluctant at first. And I said, look, this is a great promo tool to work the new album that wasn't out yet. I think it was coming out in April that year. Mm. This tour was in January. Well, at that time, I think the only black metal that Europe had seen was the Enslaved and Immortal tour.
I think the Fuck Christ as well had been there, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
That might have been it, yeah.
Something, yeah, but it was like, you know, this type of music was still very new and very fresh on the continent then. And, you know, of course, everyone had read all of the media reports about the murders and the arson attacks. So when we opened up on that tour, I remember it was a very mixed reaction at first. The first couple of songs, people saw the makeup and like, these guys are fucking Nazis, you know, like those guys from, which, you know, come on. Yeah. Anyway, by the end of our set, I mean, we totally won them over.
Yeah.
You know, and it was really a great promo tool for pushing the new album that was going to be released. Yeah. And it did great.
Yeah.
I mean, Rock Hard, Metal Hammer, all of the German mags really got behind it and were like, wow,
this is
black metal, but it's different.
Yeah.
It's not like what the Scandinavians are doing. It's got its own niche. It's different. And, you know, obviously, you know, we were inspired by Anathema and MDB as well. That's why we had those kind of really melodic doomy parts, as you'll know.
The
Scandinavians didn't really have that kind of thing.
No, there's a little dash of misery that goes with most of the music.
Exactly.
That sort of Midlands across into Ireland kind of area, this gloom that permeates, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, part of recording and working at Academy, you know, that brings that out even more, you know, because that's... You know,
yeah.
yeah.
Well, you remember, just like you get up in the morning, I have nothing to do with, for singing, so you just walk, go around to the you know, the spa around the corner, and every morning would just be scenes of domestic violence outside, just fucking people fighting.
Oh yeah.
Kids throwing stones at you with bags of cans, and
walking
into a local bar would be like darts would stop in midair.
Oh God, like the sports of
Lamb. Yeah.
You made me miss.
Yeah, brutal, brutal stuff. Some gloomy place, but yeah, it's, but that whole, because then the Scandos had this cold sound, I guess, geographically, southern bands, that warm sound, the Rotting Christ, Varathron, but in the middle, and especially in the UK and Ireland, there is this kind of air of kind of sodden melancholy and sort of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Sodden? No, but you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Very melancholic. Yeah.
And so then we go to, then was the Vampire was a sort of compromise.
That was our get out of jail free card.
Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite Cradle things going back to listen to is Vampire.
It's mine too.
It has
mine
a really great energy to it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, by that time, it was a different lineup. I mean, we were broke as fuck.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we were all on the dole.
Yeah.
You know, Cacophonous, they hadn't accounted to us or anything, and we knew that there was money there.
Yeah.
And it was, but at the same time, even though we were broke, we were happy and we were all united.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we all had the same vision for the common goal, you know. And I think it's that kind of camaraderie and that relationship, that's what gets you through those hard times, you know. We don't need fucking money, we've got each other.
Also you don't kind of miss what you don't have in a way. I mean,
exactly, yeah.
People say to me, you know, things like in this situation that we're in, they will say to me, oh, you know, there's other economies here and there. And I'd say to them, look, I at the moment I tour for nothing. I've done it many times before. I've been poor before. I don't really give that much of a fuck about money to be kind of constantly worried about. Of course, there's some concerns, but to be constant, people go, oh, you can do it online. It's like, you know what? You can't. It's part of it is that human process that is sort of irreplaceable. And the sense that, you know, you would have done it for no money. I mean, we did for 20 years. So, still do. So, you know, so like you don't miss what you don't have in that sense, you know, sometimes.
You know? Yeah. I mean, right. How I feel right now after this whole year or so, this pandemic shit, I mean, I would not complain one bit if I was in a 10-hour van ride right now going to a gig.
No, I think I'd quite look forward to that. There's a good solid 14 hours ahead between in Pennsylvania and whatever, you know. I'm like, I'm in. Yeah,
totally. You know, it's like 10 hours in a van right now to a gig, bring it.
Yeah. One of those ones in the US, you know, where you have to stop in the petrol station and you find the, you know, the kind of amphetamine pills with the angriest animal on them.
A hornet
versus buffalo or whatever. And you go, right.
Yeah, totally.
14 hours. We've got to push through to whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah. The truck of speed pills.
Yeah.
No. They're just called Grr and Arr.
My favorite one was called, had a hornet on it. Like, which is that's got to be good for you, putting something which has a hornet advertising it in here, buddy.
It's I really mean, you know, being having an 8-hour layover in an airport right now, I'd welcome it with open arms.
I hear you.
You know,
so then we go on to this is the kind of the move to Music for Nation, and then Cradle kind of explodes, right?
Yes. Well, what happened, you know, so we got out of the Cacophonous contract. We delivered Vampire. We got the master tapes for Dusk. We'd gone, they put us in the studio, in UB40 studio, actually, in Birmingham. It's not there anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, in Digbeth. Great studio. And I got to say, the UB40 guys are some of the coolest dudes I've ever met. You know, and really, really nice people, you know, super hospitable. We got a good deal on the studio because we actually went back there for Cruelty.
Yeah.
So we re-recorded. The only thing that's stayed from the original recording of Dusk is the drum tracks. Everything else got wiped.
Yeah.
And we just built it up from the drum tracks onwards. So that was delivered. MFN, they really, really pushed us. I mean, it just seemed to blow up overnight, Alan. You know, it was
No, it was everywhere. You
know, yeah, from the moment we signed the contracts, the next thing, the album's out. The next thing, you know, we've got to do MTV Live in the studio.
I remember that too.
Yeah. Like Headbangers Ball interview, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then the first tour we did for the album was actually Opeth supporters.
Oh, yeah. I think I might have seen that in London, maybe. I'm not sure. I know I saw Opeth and Ye in London in maybe 96?
Yeah.
No, that would be, yeah. I can't remember.
Yeah, 96. And the tour went great. I mean, we were doing signing sessions like every other day, you know, like at Virgin Megastore in Paris, you know, HMV in Amsterdam, back when, you know, record stores existed.
Yeah.
And it was great. I mean, but everything was happening so fast and we were young.
Yeah.
And looking back, I mean, you know, when you're 22, 23, it's really hard to, you know, well, we didn't even know the industry really back then either.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just like a continuous party stroke holiday.
Yeah.
You know, and it's only as you get older that you'll know as well that you start to understand the business and like, hey, wait a minute, this and this. And you start questioning things.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, once money and fame came into the equation,
yeah,
and that's when certain people's attitudes started to really change. And, you know, then there became a division. Management, you know, management came in on the crest of the deal. They didn't do anything and they took 20% straight off the top of our advance for doing nothing. The deal was already in place.
Yeah.
And they basically saw Danny as like, okay, we're going to market him as like the UK's Marilyn Manson, great, you know, stroke Rob Zombie.
Yeah.
Hence him changing his name to Danny Filth, you know. And that was kind of, I could see how it was going. You know, they weren't really managing the band as a whole. They were managing him, and we were like, you know, the disposable heroes, if you like.
Yeah, but it still gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and then you come to Cruelty, which is just basically, I think at this stage, Cradle of Filth is almost like household names. I mean, even people, everybody knew.
We were on TV, you know. I mean, we were on like it's children's TV pro. My step parents are aliens. You know, one of the kids is playing Cradle of Filth. You know, the BBC did a documentary on us.
Living with the enemy, wasn't it?
I fucking hated that. I didn't want to do it, but I went along because, you know, any publicity is good publicity, so they say.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the typical thing. Whenever like the BBC or the media try and do like anything to do with like heavy metal, they kind of do it in a mock way where they're kind of like taking the piss out of you because they don't take it serious because they don't understand it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that was the whole angle of the BBC thing. And I just didn't want to be a part of it, you know. Yeah. They wanted to put
comes across all right.
Yeah. I mean, well, if you see scenes with me, I'm just like, I don't want to be here. You know? And, I got so stoned, I had to be sedated 24/7 just to deal with the bullshit, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they wanted to do stuff like, you know, put fly on the wall cameras on the tour bus. Oh, but we can't have no bad language, no drug abuse. You know, it's like, well, what the fuck? Why the fuck are you here then? This is heavy metal, for fuck's sake. You know, what do you think it is? We're all in bed by 9.
Yeah. Tucked
in with like, you know, a nice hot Horlicks.
Yeah. Well,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was kind of, you know, they always do it, you know, whenever any kind of television production does anything related to heavy metal, there's always kind of like that piss-takey edge to it. Like, you know, and I just didn't want to be a part of it. But it certainly helped, you know, raise the profile.
And what about the first US tours? Can you remember going to America for the first time?
Well, the first time we went to America was just a one-off in 97 when we played the Milwaukee Metal Fest.
Oh, yeah, the old B1. I never managed to make it to one of them. I heard it was a disaster.
Well, you know how it is in the States anyway, you know, compared to Europe. I mean, they really need to get their shit together, you know. We were direct support to Venom, the original lineup.
The reformed Venom, yeah.
Yeah, and the night before it was Exodus and SOD.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I ended up getting so fucking shit-faced. I ended up I ended up getting carted away by the paramedics, and I don't remember.
All right, yeah.
And Venom were fucking terrible.
Oh, yeah?
You know, everyone was there to see him because it was the original lineup. Yeah. And they had all the production, you know, the bells and the whistles, and it was like, it looked great. It, like, aesthetically, it was like, whoa, like Hammersmith.
Yeah.
But, mate, it was like, nah, the sound was, because it was in an old ballroom too.
Yeah.
So it's not acoustically designed for, you know, music, yeah, you know, like this kind of music.
Yeah.
And they fucking sounded terrible, but, yeah, you know, it was cool to see.
Yeah, I remember the first time, going to Brazil and like 30, 40 foot high ceilings, and you're going like, what, how?
Yeah.
Not the place to put,
exactly,
you know, fucking drums, and this is going to, yeah, be cavernous and massive. And
yep, that's what it was like. And then because it was like straight in and out for the weekend, I mean, we were jet lagged. Plus, we got busted at Chicago because we were smoking weed in the van on the way down to Heathrow.
Okay.
And the dogs totally picked up on our clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
And this was our first time in the States, and we were like scared rabbits. Like, we haven't got any drugs. We haven't got any drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
So eventually, you know, after the searches and the bullshit, they let us go. But I was back home before I even knew it, and it was like, wow, did that weekend really happen?
Yeah, because that was
that was the first time in the States. So then we did a short run. We did a short run for Cruelty where we just played four key shows. It was like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, we did Mexico beforehand, but we all got sick in Mexico.
Oh, yeah?
First time in Mexico, yeah. And, you know.
The Mexico belly, or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Gian shat the bed, but he contested it by saying, well, technically, shit is solid waste, and that's just liquid. Huge streak on his sheets, and the cleaner just going nuts and swearing at us in Spanish.
He's a funny chap, all right, yeah.
Yeah. But the Cruelty dates we did in the US were amazing. I mean, you know, when we played San Francisco, you know, all of my Bay Area peers were there at a show, yeah, you know, like Exodus, Testament, you know, Rob Thim was there, you know. I mean, I love Violence.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
You know, Steve Esquivel from Defiance, who went on to pick him. Yeah, you know, the Bay Area. You played San Francisco. It's a great town.
Yeah.
Great music town. And, yeah, that was really special. And New York as well, because, you know, Lilka came out.
Yeah, of course.
You know, Charlie from Anthrax. It was just great fun. But, you know, really, really heavy toll on them, on your body, because we were it was all fly-ins.
Yeah.
So we'd fly in a day before, we'd do press, then we'd do the show. And of course, after the show, you want to rage and party. And
yeah,
so, you know, yes, well, we've got a 5 a.m. lobby call tomorrow morning. So,
yeah.
And it was just like that for like 10 days.
Yeah. But that's when you need those pills with the angry animals on them. You know?
Yeah, exactly. You need a shot of grr.
Yeah. Or if, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. And then we returned from that to Europe. We did the European tour with Gorgoroth and Old Man's Child and Ein Hirer.
Oh, yeah.
And that's where I got to meet Froda for the first time.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And then the later on, then we did all the festivals that year in 98. And then towards the end of 98, November, December, we toured with Napalm and Borknagar.
Oh, yeah.
And it was on that tour where, you know, it had come to an end for me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't enjoy touring anymore, being around certain people, you know, and I knew things were going on behind the scenes that I had no control of regarding money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we were headlining, selling out like 1,500 to 2,000 capacity venues in Europe.
Yeah.
But only coming home with T-shirt money.
Yeah, and also I saw you at I think is it VAC in 98, and like,
yes,
Cradle was like just from the top, but before Manowar, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And Manowar was, yeah, pretty dire.
Yeah, well, I've had this discussion with someone else recently. I love them on record, but I just can't take them serious live.
I've seen them play. I saw them play two or three times back then in the 90s. I didn't see them in the 80s, obviously. Do you remember they played in London with Skyclad? maybe 92. Yes. I was supposed to go for that, but I had an exam, you know, do the ferry train thing and had an exam and couldn't go.
Yeah.
So 96, I saw them the first time, I think, in Italy, and they were great. No talking, just playing. And then Dynamo, yeah. I was like, oh, right, here we go. And then speeches, solo song, solo speeches. Yeah, was, you know, with the greatest of, I wanted to love it, but it was pretty meandering.
Yeah. that brings me to our time on tour with Twilight of the Gods when we were having our Manowar sessions and Priest sessions.
Yeah, yeah.
Great times. Yeah, great times. I hope we can go back to that sometime soon.
Yeah, I think that's what we all have to hope for, that there's some, I think without some, you know, even for me, like a sort of natural born pessimist, I still have my optimism that somehow we recalibrate ourselves into finding something that we had before, you know, or else, I don't know. I'm going to have to become I think I'm going to have to become a serial killer or a politician. Or
yeah. Well, be a serial killer, please.
Okay. Well,
maybe politicians.
They're almost the same thing, I suppose. Yeah. So that.
Well, go get the politicians.
Yeah. So that brings us to about 99, right? So then we start to get into Dimmu Borgir territories, then, right?
Yes.
So how did that happen?
Well, at the end of the Cradle Napalm Butnagar tour, I decided I was going to quit. And I said to Shane from Napalm, who's a good friend, as you know, you know, I'm thinking about knocking this on the head because, you know, there's too many red flags. You know, there's no transparency when it comes to money.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, there's things just aren't right. And I'm not getting the answers that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
You know, and I've just been told, oh, you're just the drummer. Just go away or smoke some more weed, you know.
Yeah.
Why do you need to do the accounts? You know, why do you have to rock the boat? You know, very dismissive towards, you know, what are legitimate requests.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, on that basis alone, you know, I was just like, nah, I'm not going to do this anymore. So I went to Los Angeles with Shane for New Year, where I ended up actually co-writing three songs on the Brewery album.
Oh, yeah.
And I had no intention of going to join Brewery or anything. I went there for a vacation to clear my head.
Yeah, yeah.
With Shane. We stayed at Jesse's parents and Juan Brujos, the singer from Brewery. And, you know, he's like, hey, you know, have you got any ideas? And I had these drum beats, which the Cradle guys didn't really like, and they ended up being three songs on the Brujerismo record.
Oh yeah.
And because of my relationship there and my time there during that vacation, you know, the guys just said, you're in the band now, that's it. So that was something great for me. But that time in Los Angeles, the New Year's Eve 98 99, that's when I decided I'm done with Cradle. And at the time, I just happened to reach out to Peter Tatgren.
Yeah.
You know, look, keep this on the down low. I'm quitting Cradle. I'm looking to join another band, you know, hopefully something in Scandinavia.
Yeah.
If you know of anyone or anything, could you put the feelers out for me? Because, you know, at the time he was like the number one guy producing Enslaved, Immortal, yada, 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 Marduk. And so he said, well, funnily enough, Dimmu Borgir are looking for a new drummer. And he put me in touch with Stian. You know, we spoke over the phone, and he basically said, "Well, come over to Norway, and you know, we'll meet up. You know, we'll audition, play a few songs, just hang out, get to know each other, and we'll see how it goes." So I went to Norway, and pretty much, you know, the first song I played, they were all looking at each other, nodding their heads. So I kind of knew that. Yeah, I think I've got this.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we went out to Elm Street and got absolutely shit-faced. And,
yeah.
You know, and at the time I was a little bit nervous and, you know, like I had my guard up because so many of the Norwegian bands talk shit about Cradle in the press because they were jealous, you know. It's like they're not even Scandinavian, but why are they the fucking most popular band?
Sure, yeah.
It's like, well, and I pissed off quite a few people. It's like, well, what you Norwegians don't understand is black metal comes from Newcastle upon Tyne, Stockholm, and Copenhagen, not Oslo.
Mm.
Oh, but we're the second generation. No, but I'm fucking first generation.
Yeah.
Newcastle on Tyne, baby.
Yeah.
You know, and because I'd got my guard up and, you know, I was a little bit, you know, everyone talks shit and a lot of, you know, in the press, like, oh, if we see those Cradle of Filth wankers, you know, there's going to be war. So I was in Oslo on my own in, in Elm Street going, well, I'm here then. So where's the fucking war? Let's have it.
Yeah.
You know, being the Brit hooligan.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
They're just not confrontational people, are they? And no. It's all in the press. It's, you know, misunderstood, like misquoted.
Yeah.
And I actually became really good friends with quite a lot of people in the scene and, you know, people that before had talked shit about me.
Yeah,
but, you know, after a couple of beers, you know, and this and that,
yeah,
you know, we're all cut from the same cloth.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So did you move there then though, or were you just going back and forth?
I was kind of going back and forth. Like I'd be there for like 2 months or a month and I'd come home and I'd go back again. So I was kind of living a double life.
Mm.
You know, I had a wife and kid here, but I was also working there. So it's kind of, you know, as expensive as Norway is too.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was like, you know, a bit of a balancing act, you know, because I've got to make sure my family's taken care of, the bills are paid, but also I have to live and travel and, you know, just one day just living in Norway is so expensive, you know, just getting the bus into town and, but, you know, buying lunch, you know, it's a holy shit.
Yeah.
But because I joined right on the eve of, right on the beginning of the Spiritual Black Dimensions touring cycle, we did the world tour for that album. Then at the same time, we were writing the Puritanical record in between Spiritual Black Dimensions touring.
Sure.
And then, what was it? 2000. Yeah. September 2000, we went into the studio for Edmund to record it.
So,
and I totally went for the triggered drum thing because Hellhammer did it on Grand Declaration. Yeah.
Really?
You know, it's like, I want the hell. Yeah. Listen to the first, because they remixed it, haven't they?
Yeah.
They've done a remix of Grand Declaration. Well,
yeah,
the
sure.
The first one, it's all triggered by B drums.
Yeah, yeah. You wanted that? Like,
well, yeah, I wanted something similar, but not the same sounds.
Really? All right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was that, you know, yeah, it was 20 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Triggers, and you know, it was all, ooh, this, you know. Like now, I mean, I would totally do something different. And what I've heard from Sven from Dimmu is that they're actually remixing the Puritanical record for its 20th anniversary this year.
Yeah.
So hopefully I'll see some residuals from it, you know. But I'm curious to see what they how they've remixed it because they kind of blame me for making them sound like Pantera.
But so by my estimation, right, this must mean that you have realistically played on, let's say, the two biggest selling second wave of black metal albums that have been released, which is Cruelty and the Beast and Puritanical Misanthropia. They must be 500,000 each, right? 400,000 or 500,000.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So you've played on both, like in my estimation, probably the two or three selling black metal second wave records that there's been.
But I think Nightside Eclipse is up there too.
I don't think it's as, I think it's more, I think that's at about 200,000, 160,000, 70,000. I mean, it's a lot, maybe a bit more, but I think Cradle and Dimmu was kind of in that bracket above because it broke so big in America. You know, when you were selling probably 150,000, 200,000 in America, maybe. But I was thinking about it the other day and I was going, fucking Nick has played on, I think, probably the two biggest selling black metal records. What do you think about that?
I haven't really stepped back and thought of it like that. I think it's quite an achievement. It's
something
I'm very proud of, you know.
That's what it's written here in my notes to fucking mention it.
Yeah.
It's a monolith.
Now you mention it. Yeah, it's wow. I've never looked at it like that, but wow, I'm really proud. Yeah. It's,
For sure. Yeah, yeah.
And I definitely left my mark on those bands, you know, during my time. So
yeah. And that's what I was thinking about that there yesterday when we arranged this to speak, and I was thinking to myself, first of all, find the Monolith 7 inches and the Catalepsy thing, and then go, oh, you know, we need to talk about the fact that those two records almost you know that period between 96 and 2000, you had about two or three home run albums that sold tons and tons of records.
Yeah.
And that's really something, you know. That really is fucking something. You know?
Back then when people bought records. Great. I'm very proud of what I achieved, and you know, looking back now in hindsight, when you say it like that, it's like, wow. Definitely. I mean, after my time, the bands, both bands, sound changed, and you know, this and that, and so. I'm quite humbled by it.
Yeah, chuffed, man. But that's why I was thinking about it yesterday. And I was there going, I wonder, has Nick really thought about it in those terms, you know, because it is quite something, you know.
It's difficult to reflect on those kind of things when, you know, you're cooped up in your apartment on your own during this bullshit, you know, and then somebody on social media will say, you know, it's because of you that I play drums today, you know, and it's like, I've said the same thing to Dave Lombardo and Gene Oglin when I've met them, you know, it's because I'm here because of you. You're the guys that made me want to do this. You know, and and for like, you know, someone like Gene to give me props on his instructional DVD when he could have mentioned any other drummer in the world.
Yeah.
And he mentions Nick Barker, you know, it's like, wow. I get weirded out, you know, with people giving me the adulation, and I feel embarrassed, you know.
Yeah, because
I know my faults and my weakness.
Well, it's a kind of
you know what I mean, and like,
yeah, it's a kind of English Irish thing. We kind of, people here are a little bit different, but they're kind of the same thing. We kind of are a bit uncomfortable with.
Yeah,
like it feels weird. Phrase, you know.
You know, I'm just some fucking knobhead kid from some working class mining town, you know.
Yeah.
That, you know, I tossed it off in high school, and you know, the careers officer came in, and what are you going to do, Nicholas? Well, I'm going to join a band and tour the world. Anyway, less of the fairy tale, son.
Yeah.
And I actually stood up and told him, "Go and get fucked. The music industry is a legitimate industry."
Yeah.
You know, because here. And it's, I don't know how it is back where, you know, for you, but, you know, our job prospects here, it was like, okay, you either go in the foundry or the pit.
Mm.
You know, it was either steelworks or coal mining.
Yeah.
You know, unless you were like one of the nerdy kids and like, you know, I'm going to be an IT operator. It's like, what's IT?
we were sort of stuck in between. There was, I mean, Dublin in the early 90s, late 80s wasn't too far away from that, but obviously Dublin being the capital had a few more opportunities, but still most people just fucking emigrated or, you know.
Yeah.
So I spent years on the dole and fucking, you know, trying to make something of music, and it took 15 years before anything kind of clicked into place, or 14, 15 years, you know. But then you faced into the 2000s, then still in Dimmu and, you know, moving on ahead.
Yeah, well, you know, we did some really, really good tours. I mean, we toured at the US with Cannibal Corpse, The Haunted, and Lamb of God were the openers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a great package. I mean, you know, like, we were playing, like, 50, you know, like, kind of like House of Blues-style places, you know.
Yeah.
1,500, 2,000 capacity venues. And it was great. We actually played in Old Bridge, New Jersey.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I was like, oh, man, the fucking Old Bridge Militia. You've got to do a shout-out to the Old Bridge Militia. And of course, the Norwegians didn't get it.
You know,
like, fuck, we're in Old Bridge.
Yeah.
You know,
proper live on deck fucking shout out. Yeah.
That, but I forget the name of the club we played, but I don't think it's there anymore. Mm. But yeah, totally. Like, I was tripping on Live on Dead, and the same thing. You know, when you play Los Angeles the first time, and you see the signs on the freeway for Long Beach, you know, you just think Maiden.
Yeah.
You know,
I remember the first time we went to play in LA, and a grumpy guitar player from Mordell, he's just like, oh, I can see you do all that shit you like Doc, and it makes sense here.
Totally.
Yeah. Because, you know, you're from some miserable housing estate in North County Dublin, which is sort of grey and raining and gloomy.
Yeah, totally.
And then you get that, it's like, oh, right, there's women in their bikinis in a tiki bar, and there's palm trees and there's sunshine. He's like,
yeah,
this makes sense.
You know, you spend any time at the Rainbow too, and it's like, you see all the has-beens, you know, like, geez. I mean, I remember, you know, everyone's met Ron Jeremy there, but I remember I bumped into Rick James before he died there.
Really?
And I was just like, man, I love your shit. And he's like, thanks, big guy. You know, and yeah, you see all kinds of people there, you know, like, I'd seen Chris Holmes there one time, you know, he was a fucking mess. Lemmy was always there.
Yeah,
it's like, wow, this is like Mecca of, you know, fucking the LA scene.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Rainbow. And yeah, it's great, but it's funny. The guitarist, mate, I see how you like all that Doc and shit now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Totally.
It makes sense here. Yeah, I was like, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, no. Yeah, I love rap. I'm a rat and roller, and I'm proud of it.
Roller,
Don't tell Bailoff that. He would have killed me.
Yes, it is. So then we're moving up to, like, end of, what, middle 2000s. You playing in Brewery as well then, or what's going on?
Yeah, yeah.
And the first lockup is when, in a few years after that, or around the same
time? The first lockup came out in 98, 99.
Okay,
I was still in Cradle then.
Yeah.
But management tried shutting it down, saying you can't do any other side projects. And I said, well, we don't have any written agreement that states that.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can go and fuck off.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so we did the first lockup record with Tatgren. We went over to his place. It was a mix. We recorded the music at Andy Sneap's place.
Yeah.
At his old studio, like below his dad's, like, factory where Sabbath used to rehearse. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we tracked all the music there, but then we went over to Abyss in Ludvika to do the vocals with Pete. And yeah, it was great. And then we were supposed to, we had so many offers. We'd even been offered to open for Immortal and Angel Corpse in the States.
Yeah, yeah.
Peter was all like, yeah, yeah, I'm all good. But then when it come down to actually applying for the work visas, it's like, oh, I can't do it because I've got the new Marduk album to do. And so we had to turn down so many offers. So in the end, we just said, look, we're going to go with Thomas Lindberg, because at the time, you know, there was no At the Gates at that time. They were well and truly done.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I've been friends with Tomba since like 91.
Yeah, yeah.
So it just made sense, you know, to get him in. And then, you know, we did a few albums with him, etc. And during that time, Jesse passed away.
Yeah.
So then we got Anton in and, you know.
Yeah.
I got fired from Dimmu, and for quite a few years. I mean, it really hurt getting fired. I've never been fired before.
Yeah.
So it was a real big dent to my pride and my ego.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so then I fell into a little bit of depression, and that's kind of like where my marriage broke down. And at that time, there was no real like drumming gigs happening for me.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I spent like the next 8 to 10 years tour managing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I started off tour managing for Metal Easy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, which, you know, that was...
I used to work on Metal Easy tours as well, like 20 years ago, yeah.
Well, you know, that was how I broke my teeth into the TM game. And, you know Metal Easy. And the last tour I did, you know, he owes me €3,000.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which I'll never see, but I'm not the only one who...
Was that the Dark Funeral tour, was it?
No, it was... when I broke up, when my marriage broke down and me and my wife had split up, I just totally put all of my focus into work.
Mm.
And I said to Johan at Metal Easy, look, you know, I don't want to go back to England. Can you keep me on tour?
Yeah.
So I literally went from tour to tour to tour. I was in Europe and I tour managed Nile a couple of times, Propane, Hate Eternal, Morbid Angel. I literally one tour would finish in Barcelona. I'd fly from Barcelona to Helsinki, start the next tour. That tour would finish in Milan. I'd fly from Milan to Amsterdam, start the next tour. It was like that for 4 months.
It's hard, you know, hard hold on the body and on the brain, that, yeah.
Yeah, but I really enjoyed tour managing because, you know, it was that sense of control. I mean, it's a very thankless job.
Mm.
You know, shit runs downhill and, like, the band blame the tour manager. the bus driver blames the tour manager, the agent, the manager, you know, and it's...
But it's great. I did it once or twice, but it's a great feeling when it all runs smoothly.
Yeah.
And the ability to solve problems on the fly is a really satisfying thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it is quite stressful and there's a lot of pressure sometimes, but, you know, when you come up with one of those bullshit obstacles and, you know, the band are all down there, they're fighting within each other and you... pull everyone out of it and we come through the other side and they all thank you and you know you're the hero of the hour. It's a good very rewarding.
Yeah, it is.
And at the end of the tour, I can honestly say at the end of every tour I did, the money was to the fucking penny and I made sure everyone got home safe.
Yeah.
So my job was done.
Yeah.
And then throughout my tour, sorry, go on.
Do you feel that you needed a little bit of a break from playing to then get back into it with better energy than when you came in a few years later? Or
I think so, yeah, because the whole the whole Dimmu and getting fired from Dimmu really hurt me. It really, because I didn't really get a legitimate reason. It's just like we don't want you in the band anymore. It's like, well, you know, usually don't I get a verbal warning or know, can we sit down and talk about this like adults? Like, okay, if you want to continue working with us, we have to make some changes or none of that. You know, it was just like, you're gone, bye. Yeah. So I felt after the five years with the band and the two most successful records, I felt deeply hurt. You know, I thought we were friends and I thought, you know, if it was really that bad, couldn't we have sat down and talked about it?
Yes.
But if you know Scandinavian, they're not big talkers.
No, maybe not.
You know.
Yeah.
Not unless it's like, you know, 4 a.m. and the 3 bottles of vodka in.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, something similar. There's a certain sort of, I suppose, social. What's the best word? I'm not sure how to describe it. There's less of that sort of problem solving chat banter thing that goes on.
They're
a little bit more socially isolated, maybe mentally or something.
Definitely.
It gets just their way. Imagine if you'd been in a Finnish band, hey, no one would have said end.
Yeah, that's true.
They're my favorite. Yeah, yeah. They're my favorites, the Finns, because they're fucking absolutely nuts.
Oh, the worst mistake I ever made was trying to keep up drinking with Mika from Impaled Nazarene.
Oh, yeah.
He gave me fucking food, alcohol poisoning for 3 days.
Yeah, he did one of the funniest things I've ever seen. We're playing with Impaled Nazarene and 1349. And he was, you know, or hang on, Mika, he's sitting, you know, talking to me in his little tiny underpants and Donald Duck shoes or whatever he's wearing. And we're drinking whiskey after the gig and Frost came in trying to eat his bolognese, but also hold a cape over so we couldn't see him. So Mika just goes over and just stands there in his little Donald Duck underpants. No, nothing else on. Well, Frost, how is your spaghetti? It is tomato-y enough for you? Do you think? Yes, it's fine. He's drinking with him can get you into some trouble. That's for sure.
It definitely did. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, back to the thing. I needed to go work on the other side of the industry to kind of clear my head and, you know, to kind of take a step back from the playing and, okay, so, all right, you've had a bit of time out, you've worked on the other side, you know, let's see, you know, what happens.
Yeah.
And during that time too, I was doing little bits and bobs with Brewery around the world.
Yeah.
You know, also recorded another lockup album, but things were quite sporadic.
Yeah.
You know, in the late 2000s, early 2010s. You know, but everything seemed to just turn around all of a sudden.
Yeah, it seemed like then you were talking like you were playing, you were helping out Testament. There was Nuclear Assault. You were playing in Nuclear Assault. When were you?
Yeah.
What else were you playing? I mean, obviously the thing we did together, Twilight of the Gods thing. But were you playing in SOD? No, you weren't as well, were you? Or were you?
No. What happened was Billy contacted Danny.
Sure.
He wanted to do something called United Forces, which was kind of like a spin-off of SOD.
Yeah.
And Lilka suggested me and Anton.
Yeah.
And I'd spoke to Billy many times, you know, we were all good. And then all of a sudden, it just went cold. I mean, he got cold feet, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's something to, like legalities or whatever. But, you know, I also went on to play Nuclear Assault.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I'm still a part of.
Oh, yeah?
During my time with Exodus,
yeah.
I played on one Exodus tour when they co-headlined with Overkill.
Right.
They had some downtime. And Tom, the drummer, had gone and booked a holiday in Mexico with his lady.
Yeah.
You know, because it's downtime. And then all of a sudden, from out of nowhere, this tour offer came up in Europe to co-headline with Overkill.
Yeah.
Like 20 shows. I think Gamma Bomb were the opener.
Yeah.
And so Gary said it was either you or Hoagland, and Hoagland was busy. So he said, you know, can you do this tour? Now, straight away, I mean, you know, Exodus, Thunder by Blood, it's one of my favorites of all time.
We've spent many evenings listening to that.
You know, both of us saying the same shit, aren't we?
Yeah.
And so it was a no-brainer. I mean, before he could even finish speaking to me, it was like, yeah, I'll do it. And so what happened was the first show was in London at the O2 in Islington.
Yeah, yeah.
So they flew in. They flew into the country. We had 2 days rehearsal at Sneap's and then straight on the tour. I also played for Possessed as well, which, you know how that went down.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, that was a real like stab in the back because, you know how much I love Possessed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I spent so long.
Seven Churches on Vinyl or fuck off. Yeah.
Exactly. But I spent so long, like months, learning the set because the production was so shitty on those records, and they're not in time. You can hear the guitars speeding up to catch the drums, you know.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time, trying to get the set down and everything, and only for Mr. Becerra to leave me hanging in Spain.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. It paid me €375 for 18 shows, which equates to €23 a show. You know,
goddamn.
With no sit down. Look, Nick, the tour didn't work out as I expected. Here's all the numbers, the figures, blah blah blah. This is what's left, and this is no. He gave the money to the guitarist to give me while him and his father hightailed it to the airport. So, you know, just his behaviour. It's like. It's that's really not how you treat people.
But isn't that mental though? In the last, let's say, years, you have you end up playing, you know, helping out Exodus, Nuclear Assault, Possessed, all these kind of people that you would have grown up listening to in the 1980s. That it kind of comes circle that you end up, and the Testament thing as well and stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I had posters of all these guys on my walls in the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I looked up to these guys. These are my childhood heroes. So, you know, to get the opportunity to play for, you know, not just one of them, but, you know, a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, yeah, three, four, five of them. So that's what...
fucking hell.
It's mad when you think about that, right? So this is what I was thinking about yesterday, is that I was thinking to myself, right, Barker's played on probably the two biggest selling black metal records of that second generation, and then also played with a whole hand, like five of the bands that you grew up listening to from the 1980s.
Yeah.
Not bad for an old fucking hooligan from Chesterfield, then, is it really?
I know. I was thinking the same thing. I mean, my only regret is I never got to, like, at least sound check with Slayer or something. I mean, that would have been the cherry on top for me.
Yeah.
You know, even when Gary was in the band, you know, if he's like, come on, Barker, get on the kit, let's do Antichrist.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be like, oh.
Yeah. Yeah, but but all things considered, you know, this last year has been weird. I'm the same as you. I felt sort of alienated and frustrated and angry and this and the other. But there's been moments where I have actually sat and thought, like, holy fuck, this is 30 years of doing this, and looking back at all the records that you've made and things you've achieved. It's difficult to kind of put it into context. But knowing you, I knew you'd be feeling the same way I would. So I was thinking about this stuff yesterday, kind of going... you know, kind of maybe put some of this stuff into perspective about all of the things you played on and those kind of bands. And when it all racks up, it's quite, it is quite the achievement, you know? They're quite the achievement.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You know, yeah, when I take a step back and look at it, it's like, fucking hell, yeah, wow. You know, just some knobhead kid from Chesterfield. I played with all my heroes from the Bay Area. And,
yeah. The way I kind of look at it is that it's been a kind of an amazing ride. I just wasn't quite ready to get off just yet. You know,
yeah.
I wanted to get off on my own terms, not be shoved off. Like shoved out of a moving car out of the, you know, that's kind of a bit how I felt. But like I said, I mean, even for a pessimistic bollocks like me, I still hold out some hope that all of the things that are fueling my negativity out of this, like I just being on the screen all the time and I, you know, self-isolation, all that kind of stuff, that's partly informing my opinion of all of the stuff, and that there is another side of it which just wants to get back to normal, and that somehow we can get back to being human beings at some stage, you know.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah,
no, that's what I want.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that the end of the world would be a bit more exciting, that I might be able to, you know, shoot robot drones out of the bunker or something. I thought it'd be a bit more bang for your buck, you know what I mean?
Yeah, or at least see a mushroom cloud on the horizon, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know,
at least then you know, right, I've got like 9 seconds, okay, I'll
exactly
wait for the, yeah.
You know, that's the, yeah, you can listen to You Suffer But Why 9 times.
So, right, I'm going to, on that note, sir, resume recording. All right, so let's presume that we're all going to get back to some form of humanity. What, you know, tell us about this Borstal thing that you've been doing. What's the story with that?
Well, I've always been a fan of punk and hardcore since the 80s, being a kid, because as you know, all the bands we used to listen to as a kid, they all wore the Discharge shirts, you know, GBH.
Minor Threat.
And stuff, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, the hardcore crossover thing, as it was called back then, you know, it was just an expansion of what we listened to. And I've always wanted to do a band like that, and like sadly,
Slaughter or something, or Ludicrous,
all of that, you know, Septic Death, Cryptic Slaughter, Minor Threat, Agnostic Front, you know, Spastic Blur, Crumbsuckers, Accused, you know, Poison Idea, all that stuff, and eventually, a couple of mates from London said they were into it and jumped on it, and it just really happened so quick. We've got an EP. That's going to be out on the April 1st on 4 Family Records. It's called At Her Majesty's Pleasure.
Oh.
Being the Borstal thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we even put A Wing and B Wing on the vinyl, you know. So I've got that dropping on April 1st. The new Brewery album is going to be dropping sometime this year.
Yeah.
We're just wrapping up the vocals on that now.
Yeah.
And, you know, me and you, we've talked to Runa and Froda about doing another Twilight of the Gods record, hopefully by the end of this year.
Yeah, hopefully so, we'll get back to that, yeah.
Yeah, so I look forward to seeing you all in South Portugal again.
Yeah, well, we have to keep pushing, or at least having some line on the horizon to work towards, or else I think we'd all go even more fucking insane than we're going, you know.
And there we go, my friends. There ends the chat with Nicholas Barker. Hope you found it interesting. Certainly was great to talk to the big man once again. All right, episode 45 of Agitators Anonymous, over and out. Hail Planet Satan, see you all soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.